Grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, with foods from around the world, including imported chocolates, cookies, coffee, extra virgin olive oil, and featuring a selection of new cheeses every week. World Harvest Foods, at the intersection of 6th and University in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
The largest portion of our operating budget here at WILL comes from you, the audience that we serve. Because we are a non-commercial public station, we're able to give you more program per hour on WILL radio. But right now, we need your help to maintain the quality, variety, and non-commercial nature of our program service. As of today, we're more than $189,000 short of our June 30th fundraising goal. Please help us close this dollar gap. Call 217-244-9455. With a contribution. Once again, the number to call is area code 217-244-9455, and we thank you very much. Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. There are a lot of people who are excited about the possibility that in the future, hydrogen and hydrogen power will meet some of our energy needs. People have talked about using hydrogen to power vehicles like automobiles and also to provide energy for buildings, big ones, and residences. Even the president in his State of the Union address last year talked about the potential for hydrogen and the importance for doing research in that area. Our guest this morning says that that's good. It's a good thing to think about alternative fuel sources. However, he says that perhaps some of the promises of hydrogen have been a little overstated and that we ought to be realistic about what hydrogen can and cannot do. Our guest is Joseph Rahm. He helped oversee hydrogen and transportation fuel cell research in various positions in the Department of Energy during the Clinton administration. At the moment, he is executive director of the Center for Energy and Climate Solutions. This is an organization that aims to help businesses and states adopt high-leverage strategies for saving energy and cutting pollution. He is the author of a recently published book that we'll be talking about this morning in this part of Focus 580. The title of his book is The Hype About Hydrogen. It is published by the Island Press. The subtitle of the book is Fact and Fiction in the Race to Save the Climate. If you're interested, you can head out to the bookstore and find the book. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. He holds a PhD in physics from MIT. He's written and lectured widely on advanced transportation technologies, on hydrogen, fuel cells, and other energy issues. He's contributed articles to a number of publications, including Technology Review, Forbes, Foreign Affairs, New York Times, others, and has been often quoted in the media on energy technology matters. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, of course, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask callers is that people are brief, and we ask that so that we can accommodate as many callers as possible. Keep the program moving. Anybody, though, who is interested can call in. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana. And we do also have the toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Rahm, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Pleasure.
We appreciate it. Just to make sure that people understand where you're coming from here right up front, you are among those who are concerned about our burning fossil fuels, what that has meant for the environment, and certainly would advocate moving towards other kinds of energy sources that are less polluting and, if possible, renewable. All those things you would say, yes, that's right.
Absolutely. Our soaring level of imported oil makes us dependent on the Persian Gulf, and I think everyone can see every time they go to the pump just the dangers of over-reliance on oil from other sources, and obviously the environment, and particularly one of the focuses of the book is the urgent need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, particularly carbon dioxide, which is heating up the planet, and the number one offender there is vehicles. The transportation sector has been the fastest growing source of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States for the last two decades.
Well, in a moment here, I think probably we ought to talk, or I'll ask you to talk, in basic terms about the hydrogen fuel cell, because I'm sure that there are probably a lot of people who are still not quite sure what it is and how it works. But let me take a step back from that and ask, because it certainly does seem to be that within the last couple of years, there's been an awful lot written about and discussed about hydrogen, and a lot of people have gotten really excited and have made these predictions about how the fact that there will be a day in the future when, as today our economy rests on oil, in the future it will rest on and run on hydrogen. Why is there so much excitement about hydrogen as an energy generator?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. One reason is that hydrogen can be made from a lot of sources. It's not a primary energy source like coal or oil or even wind that you can tap directly. You've got to make it from something, but I think people are partly excited because you can potentially make hydrogen from renewable sources of energy, like solar energy or wind power, and you can potentially run a vehicle on hydrogen, so you could imagine someday replacing imported oil with some domestically generated hydrogen that might be pollution-free. And it is the, I think all of us would like to, replace imported oil with some domestic source, and I think all of us would love to have pollution-free cars. So those two goals together have created excitement, I think, for hydrogen cars. And the second piece of it for the car is what on your car would run on hydrogen, and that is where you get to these fuel cells, which we can come back to, but they are basically pollution-free devices that take in hydrogen and oxygen and put out electricity and water. And in fact, their only emission is water. So there you've got about as pollution-free an engine as you could imagine.
Well, there, I guess you've explained essentially what a hydrogen fuel cell is. What it is it's a device that takes advantage of the fact that if you take hydrogen and oxygen and put it together, you get energy, and the only byproduct is water, which is not a problem like a lot of other byproducts would be. And it seems like, it sounds like it's a pretty simple device. It doesn't have moving parts, sounds like a fairly elegant solution to the problem. Although then the big question, as you have said, comes down to where are we going to get the hydrogen? I'm sure that there are people who think, well, hydrogen's just floating around, isn't it? You know, like oxygen and carbon dioxide and a lot of other things. But it's a little bit more difficult than just somehow grabbing it out of the atmosphere there. So that's the big question of where you're going to get the hydrogen.
Indeed. Well, I think that is, from an environmental perspective, that is the rub. Hydrogen is lighter than air, so it floats away. There's no real sources of pure hydrogen on the Earth. You have to make it from something. 95% of all hydrogen in the United States is made from natural gas, because natural gas is methane. It's one carbon atom and four hydrogen atoms. So basically, you extract the hydrogen from natural gas and you generate pollution in the process. In fact, you basically generate a lot of carbon dioxide, which is a greenhouse gas. So as of today, virtually all hydrogen in the United States and around the world is generated in processes that produce a lot of pollution, but happen to be quite cheap.
So that's, I guess, the problem. If now you're thinking about building a hydrogen fuel cell powered car, the question is, well, where are you going to get that hydrogen? You could, in fact, get it from, well, you could get it from natural gas if you had some way to distribute it and pump it and store it. You could even build a fuel cell, and I think fuel cells have been built that use gasoline, that get their hydrogen from gasoline. So, but the problem right now is that the apparently the best way that we have to do it is to use a non-renewable source for the hydrogen, which then also gets us some pollution in the bargain. So that's really not the ideal. That's not the ideal that seems to present itself when you talk about this wonderful source, non-polluting energy source.
Well, absolutely. And I think that, we've all gotten used to driving cars that aren't very expensive, that can be fueled rapidly and have a long range. These are features that are easy to do with a liquid fuel like gasoline, because liquids are easy to transport, they're easy to store, they store a lot of energy, and they give up that energy very quickly. We don't run very many vehicles on the planet on a gas. Gases are very diffuse. It's very hard to get a lot of a gas in a tank to run your car. I don't think people want to buy cars that can only go 100 miles before refueling, particularly given that, in the early stages of any transition, you're going to have a shortage of fueling stations. We have 180,000 gasoline stations in this country. It would take a considerable amount of money to build, tens of thousands of hydrogen fueling stations. So you are really limited by the fact that hydrogen is a gas, and gases are hard to transport and store. Right now, there's no good way to store hydrogen on board a car, and that remains sort of one of the biggest technical obstacles to making hydrogen cars.
Well, you, I think, have said in the book that you think that a significant number of hydrogen, to get to the point where we'd have a significant number of hydrogen-powered vehicles on the road, we're looking at maybe as long as 30 years from now?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I called the book The Hype About Hydrogen because I really think that the near-term prospects for hydrogen cars have been very overhyped. I think it would be unlikely if very many people in your listening audience purchased a hydrogen car in the next three decades, in part because the technical challenge of making a car that would be comparable to your existing car is so difficult, and in part because existing cars keep getting better. I mean, that's been the case for, all alternative fuel vehicles. The federal government and many private companies have tried over the last two decades to promote electric cars and natural gas vehicles and ethanol vehicles and methanol vehicles, and it's tough. It's tough to get a car that is desirable from a consumer point of view. It's hard to get the fuel providers to build the fueling stations until people buy the cars, but it's hard to get people to buy the cars if there's no fuel available. That's the famous chicken and egg problem. And at the same time, regular cars keep getting better. They get cleaner. And these new hybrid vehicles that are generating a lot of excitement, the Toyota Prius and soon the Ford Escape, these really raise the bar for cars because these are cars that cut pollution and gasoline consumption directly, but they run on regular fuel that you can get anywhere, and they don't cost any more. I mean, they cost a little more, but nothing like what a hydrogen car would cost. So, I think realistically, if people, want to take action over the next 10, 15 years to reduce the environmental impact of their car and to reduce their gasoline bill, they're going to be buying a hybrid.
Well, just to make sure that I understand you, it sounds as if you're saying that even if we could deal with all the technical challenges of building the vehicle, figuring out how on the vehicle to store the fuel, putting in a system of fueling stations so that people could go out and get hydrogen to put into the car, it still wouldn't really make sense unless we also had a way of producing that hydrogen without having to resort to non-renewable sources for the hydrogen. That is, we'd have to figure out some way to either use solar power or wind or something that we could use to power the process to generate that hydrogen that we then put into the system and that we then put into the vehicle.
Exactly. No, you said it exactly right. I don't think, most of your listeners would get very excited about buying this expensive car, which might have a limited range and limited fueling options, all so that they could replace their current car running on imported oil with a car that would run on hydrogen from natural gas, which itself is increasingly going to be imported. It's not going to say, you know, it's not going to be that much superior from an environmental point of view. You're still running on fossil fuels. So I don't think that that's, you know, I don't think that's going to generate a lot of sales. And unfortunately, hydrogen from renewable sources of energy is just very expensive. It would be very hard to get, you know, renewable hydrogen for under $8 a gallon of gasoline equivalent. We're talking very expensive, and I think, you know, people are pretty unhappy with gasoline at current levels, you know, of $2.50 a gallon. Hydrogen is considerably more expensive. Even what I would call dirty hydrogen from natural gas is going to be $4 a gallon equivalent. But like I said, if you want a green hydrogen, an environmentally benign hydrogen, it is just very, very expensive, which sort of brings me to one of the major points of the book, is that it's not even a very good use of renewable energy. If you've got a wind turbine, if you've got a solar power plant, what you should do with that electricity is replace coal plant with it, because that would save a lot of pollution directly. To go to all the trouble of taking your renewable power and converting it to hydrogen and building the infrastructure to ship the hydrogen and then buying a fuel cell car just to replace a new fuel-efficient car, the environmental benefits are small and you've spent a lot of money when you could have taken, like I said, that renewable power directly and replaced a coal plant and saved a lot of pollution for not a lot of money. So, you know, I think that those of us who care about the environment, our top priority in the vehicle arena is fuel efficiency, things like hybrid vehicles, and our top priority in the power sector is to see more renewable power and not new coal plants.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, and I would certainly welcome others. Let me introduce again our guest. Joseph Rahm worked in the Department of Energy during the Clinton administration. He helped run the government's program on hydrogen and fuel cells. He's the author of a newly published book titled The Hype About Hydrogen, Fact and Fiction in the Race to Save the Climate. It's published by the Island Press, which puts out a lot of books on environmental topics, so you can head out to the bookstore and look for it if you're interested. Also, questions are welcome here, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. First caller up is in Savoy on line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Good.
Hey, I worked on a project one time to there was a problem of transporting natural gas from Algeria over to the United States. And one of the things that we looked at was converting it, you know, instead of liquefying it and shipping it cryogenically, we looked at converting it to methanol and then shipping it over and then flipping it back to methane in a reformer. And I just wonder, you know, has anyone, you know, why doesn't anyone look seriously at converting coal into methanol? Because that's a good way of transporting the hydrogen. Essentially, all the hydrogen comes from, whenever you do that, you have to add steam in the reformer, and so you're converting the hydrogen from water or steam and using the carbon as the carrier, plus you have a mole of oxygen that comes along, too. So you have a, you know, from an emission point of view, you have a very benign fuel that has good energy density and so on and so forth. And I just think coal has been mean-mouthed so much, you know, that, you know, it's being overlooked as a good answer to our problem. Plus, it's a strategic answer, too.
Well, you have some thoughts about that?
Sure, absolutely. I think coal, obviously, the United States has a great deal of coal, and we use it for about half of our electricity. In the future, because of global warming, we're going to have to do something about the CO2 emissions from coal. I think the caller is correct. You can make liquid fuels or even hydrogen from coal, and if we could figure out a way to take the CO2 that came out of that, the carbon dioxide that came out of that process, and store it underground, what's called carbon sequestration, if that technical problem could be solved, then I think we could continue to use coal without harming the climate. So that is a very high priority, and I talk about that in the book. The U.S. government and other companies are working very hard to see if carbon capture and storage will work. It is not, you know, a technologically easy thing to do, but it's certainly possible, and it might ultimately be practical someday when carbon dioxide has a price. I think there's no question, by the way, that, you know, the price of gasoline is getting pretty high, and a lot of people are concerned that we're running out of, you know, conventional oil. And I think if the price of oil stays high like this, people will look at alternatives. You can certainly turn coal into various liquid fuels. You could turn it into methanol. You can also turn it into various synthetic diesel fuels, and you could turn it into hydrogen. So, you know, I think in the future we may get, you know, transportation fuels from lots of different sources. I would not be in favor of doing it from coal unless we can solve the problem of what to do with the carbon dioxide.
Yeah, we worked on another problem. It was that one you mentioned, sequestering CO2 underground.
Yeah.
Whenever you look at the material balance on even a small power plant like 75 megawatts, you're talking unbelievable amounts of CO2 you have to remove. And whenever you look at just the power that's needed to and the energy to remove the CO2 and concentrate it, it goes and it sucks the efficiency of the power plant down by another 25%. It's bad.
Yeah, there's no question about that. I think, you know, for me, global warming is the problem that will ultimately be driving all major energy decisions. Yeah, we're not at that point yet, but, you know, I think if you study the science, as I have, the United States is in great danger of being 10 degrees Fahrenheit warmer at the end of this century than it is today.
Yeah, that's an interesting problem.
And I think that what you will eventually see, I think it's entirely possible, is there will be a price for carbon dioxide, much as there is already a price for sulfur dioxide emitted by power plants. And that will encourage, you know, various strategies. You definitely lose efficiency when you sequester. On the other hand, if we can solve the problem of gasifying coal into, you know, as I'm sure you know, a syngas that's very rich in hydrogen, you can now run a turbine and you can make your coal plants more efficient. So you will lose some efficiency in the sequestration process, but you'll gain some efficiency because you're now basically have a high-energy gas rather than coal.
Right, yeah. I'll tell you what, we'll have to look at your book.
All right, well, thanks for the call.
We
are already in our midpoint here, and we will continue to talk with our guest, Joseph Rahm, in just a moment. However, one thing we need to do first, as it is the first Tuesday of the month, we need to do this. This is a test of the emergency alert system.
This message was instituted by the Illinois Emergency Management Agency. This station is participating in a required monthly test of the Illinois Emergency Alert System. This system was developed to provide information to the public during emergencies. This was a test.
And this is Focus 580 here on AM 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Again, we're talking this morning with Joseph Rahm about hydrogen and its potential to supply energy for us here in the future. He's an author of a book on this. It's titled The Hype About Hydrogen, Fact and Fiction in the Race to Save the Climate. It's published by the Island Press. And we have a number of other callers here, so we'll go next to a caller in Champaign, I believe, here, line number two. Hello.
Yes. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I very recently was at one of the local GM dealerships looking at new cars, and I asked them, are you guys going to be coming out with, various hybrid vehicles in the near future? And I was told that, no, they weren't really looking to that. They were focusing on the fuel cell as, the way they were going to go. And when they said, and they're going to do that in the next 5 years, I said, well, from what I've heard, that sounds pretty unrealistic. But they were unfazed. They said, oh, no, GM is really putting themselves into this, and they're going to have it in the next 5 years. And I just would like to get your thinking about that.
Yes. Well, certainly GM has been steadfast in claiming that they are going to have a fuel cell car by 2010. I think, to be honest with you, I've spoken to a great many people in and out of the auto industry, and it's really only General Motors that continues to believe that fuel cell cars are going to be available in that time frame. And I in the book I actually criticized them. I think it's increasingly obvious that hydrogen is not the strategy that is going to succeed in the marketplace in the next two decades, in part just because there's not going to be any hydrogen fueling stations. And hybrids, on the other hand, are becoming incredibly popular. And, you see Ford is going to be introducing an SUV hybrid. I think, they're flying off the dealer room floors. I mean, here's a car that gives you reduced gasoline bill and increased range. You don't have to go to the fueling station as often, reduced tailpipe emissions, and it can be fueled everywhere. And, compare that to a hydrogen car, which is going to have difficulty with range and fueling options. Let me just read something that was in the May issue of Scientific American. Fuel cell cars, in contrast to hybrids, are expected on about the same schedule as NASA's manned trip to Mars and have about the same level of likelihood. I think that GM is just making a huge mistake here, giving a six-year head start to its major competitor, Toyota, and even giving, a few-year head start to Ford. I personally think, and I think this will become increasingly clear, that the hybrid platform is the platform that will take over the vehicle market, because not only because it's more efficient, but it allows you to do much more sophisticated things, much more vehicle control, vehicle stability control, much more efficient use of the onboard power. You have an electric motor on board, so you can even accelerate and have haul. You can have the acceleration and hauling power of a diesel because electric motors are so good at torque. So what I think will happen is that, GM is going to be either come around quickly to realize that hybrids are the future and not hydrogen, or they're going to lose market share across the board.
Well, unfortunately, I think you're probably right about that, but they seem pretty committed, and these people at the dealership, they seemed confident about it. So,
yeah, and the weird thing about it is that, to me, is that whether hydrogen cars can succeed or not, partly that's in the hands of the automakers. Can they build a car that you would want to buy? But partly it's totally out of their hands. Are the fueling companies going to take the gamble to build fueling stations? Because after all, even if GM could deliver the world's greatest hydrogen car, I doubt you would buy it unless you were very confident that you could find fuel for it everywhere you wanted to go. So, I don't think it's good business strategy to sort of bet your company or to invest so much into a technology whose success is, to a large extent, completely out of your hands.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Well, I wonder, I think that there has been some criticism of the automakers and for their enthusiasm and they're hyping hydrogen along these lines, saying that what they're doing is they're talking about the benefits of hydrogen and saying that's going to be the next big thing, and that they're then they don't actually have to put the money and the time into improving the technology that exists. And it seems like the next big leap is going to be the hybrid, which is going to continue to – people are going to use the same filling stations. They're going to go there, and they're going to put gasoline in the car. But it's a because of the way it's designed, you'll get greater fuel efficiency, and it will pollute less. Now it seems that at least some automakers are really getting into the hybrid business, and we ought to see more and more of them. But is that other criticism still good, the fact that that maybe one reason that automakers would want to talk so much about the hydrogen-powered car is that it somehow allows them to defer making improvements in the existing car?
Yes. I mean, that is a criticism that has certainly been made. You know, General Motors, I mean, no company likes to be regulated. And the car companies don't like fuel efficiency regulations, and they have lobbied hard in the past 25 years, and as I'm sure, you know, people realize, we have not increased fuel economy standards in this country in 25 years. In fact, we've opened up these loopholes so that, you know, sport utility vehicles don't even have to have the same fuel economy as cars, and then there's another loophole that vehicles that weigh over 8,500 pounds, like the Ford Excursion and the Hummer, aren't even counted in anybody's fuel economy's averages. So, yes, particularly General Motors has been trying very hard to convince people that we shouldn't increase fuel efficiency standards for new cars. And part of their argument has been, hey, hydrogen cars are right around the corner, so don't make us build, you know, hybrids. When hydrogen is just this silver bullet right around the corner. And I think one of the points of the book, and I think it's an increasing consensus in the technical community, is that hydrogen cars are not right around the corner. And I think that, you know, from an environmental point of view, we can't wait for hydrogen cars to address problems like oil imports and global warming. Those need to be addressed now with hybrids. And you know, if fuel cells and hydrogen ultimately work, you'll want to put those engines into hybrid vehicles anyway. I mean, the thing about hybrids is that they capture the energy that's otherwise lost when you break your car. And that's a lot of energy. That's about 20% of the entire, you know, driving cycle energy is lost in braking. So that is a tremendous amount of energy to throw away. And I think ultimately, efficiency tends to win in the marketplace. So I do think most car companies are going to move towards hybrids. Certainly Toyota is going to, and I think Honda has said so. And, you know, William Clay Ford has more and more started talking up hybrids. So I think, you know, I think hybrids are the wave of the next 25 years. We should keep doing the R&D on hydrogen. I'm not against that. We should keep doing the R&D on biofuels and other technologies like that. But we can't sit around waiting, hoping that R&D solves our problem 25 years from now. It'll be so large we won't be able to solve it.
Well, let's talk with some other folks here. The next caller is Atlanta, Illinois, not Georgia, here on line number 4. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Yes.
Congratulations on your book. You know, I hear all the time about this hydrogen hype, even from even people that should know better, that it's going to be, you know, the savior of our transportation system. And obviously, it seems to me that you're right on from a technical point of view why in the short term it isn't. And usually when I call in on these energy things, you know, the one thing that I hype is conservation, as far as let's right now, in the short term anyway, let's practice extreme conservation that maybe through education we could teach people the importance of. But I like your idea on that the hybrid car that, you know, eventually hopefully will take over. Let's take this one step further. I want to ask you a question. What do you think about completely changing our transportation system? Maybe part of it would include cars like the hybrid car, but we could use some other kind of transportation system that is really efficient. And hence, you know, driving down the interstate in a hybrid car or any kind of car for a long distance to me is about the most boring thing in the world. I think in the long term, if we completely changed our transportation system, if we took the advertising angle of the freedom of the road, which on the interstate you obviously don't have, and I suppose considerable amount of driving is done on the interstate, what do you think about completely changing our transportation system to something much more efficient, maybe including several forms of ground transportation to get you to your point, including the hybrid car?
I take it you mean something particularly doing what Europe does, a lot more use of trains.
Well, of course.
I mean, there's no question that trains are, you know, a much more efficient way of getting people from point A to point B. Americans have, you know, embraced cars to an amazing extent, and in part that's because the government has spent so much money, you know, subsidizing car transportation and highways. My feeling is that at current gasoline prices and current levels of concern about the environment, people aren't going to change their behavior a lot. 20-30 years from now, I do expect the world will be a very different place. I think that come the 2020s, it will sort of become increasingly clear that we are running out of conventional oil, and gasoline prices could well be higher than they are today. And I also think that people will see just how radically the climate starts to change over the next couple of decades. And they're going to understand that driving down a highway in an SUV has very severe consequences for everyone on the planet. So, you know, I'm not expecting a lot of change in the modes of travel in this country for the next two decades. But I have no doubt that, let's say, come the year 2050, people are not going to be driving the kinds of vehicles they are today, and I would not be surprised if we see, you know, a greater use of train travel as the full impact of burning oil becomes clear to everybody.
Well, yeah, I think you're probably right. Just talking to people generally, you know, I have friends that say, I don't care what gasoline prices are, I'm going to drive where I want to go, and to me that's ludicrous. I mean, obviously, the high prices are kind of a rationing tool. But as far as other, you know, the train as we know it today, I don't necessarily mean that, but it seems like on larger scale transportation like that, you know, Europe still basically, in most cases, a train like we have here. But it seems like their technology could really move to the forefront. And with education, particularly if you had, you know, the pleasures of reading or watching a movie or whatever you do on a longer travel, it seems like the car, the main thing about the car that is appealed to the American psyche is the advertising, you know, the freedom of the road and control. But really, you know, driving a car is pretty gruesome. I mean, particularly if you're going long distances. So I'll hang up. I agree with you. I hope it happens before 2050, but you're probably right. It probably won't. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go on here to Urbana for another caller. Line one. Hello.
Hello. I thank you for poking a hole in this hydrogen bubble. I wonder if there isn't a similar problem with ethanol. People around here are very interested in ethanol, claiming it's renewable. But if you look at the figures, you see that three-quarters of the energy that you get out of that you get from ethanol is used in the production. It's split about one-third with petroleum and one-third with natural gas and one-third with coal. And so given that, how can you consider ethanol a renewable fuel even?
No, you're absolutely correct that, you know, the way we make ethanol today, we make it from corn, from the starchy, the edible part of corn, and clearly agriculture is very energy intensive, and to go to all the trouble of growing corn just to take out the part that we could eat and turn it into fuel, that is not a very efficient process. The hope has been, and when I was at the Department of Energy, we pursued ethanol that would be made from biomass, from any plant matter, not just sort of the edible part, and in fact ultimately might be made from dedicated crops that were, you know, switchgrass or fast-growing trees that were designated for that use, where the energy intensity of the process is far lower. And so, indeed, in this country, a tremendous amount of work has been going into this. So it's called sometimes called cellulosic ethanol as opposed to the corn-based ethanol. There is not yet a commercial plant to make such cellulosic ethanol, but you will see, I think, over the next few years, they will start to sprout up. By 2010, I think you'll see these plants. The fuel is still a bit pricey, but with the price of gasoline, it's certainly getting close. The goal, though, as you're quite right, is a ethanol whose energy input, the energy it takes to make the ethanol, has got to be a lot less than the energy to grow corn if this is going to be something that makes sense.
Well, if you're going to use this material to make ethanol, why I just don't quite understand it, because my impression is that making methanol is more efficient and you get just as good a liquid fuel out of methanol.
Yes, and, you know, methanol, a lot of people have tried very hard with methanol. As I'm sure you know, there's a lot of concern about the toxicity. If you talk to the fuel companies, the Shells and the BPs and the Exxons, they're not that thrilled with methanol because they feel that, you know, you look at what happened in California and with all the issues around environmental regulations, they don't think that the public is going to embrace methanol. The main nice feature about ethanol is that you can blend it straight into gasoline, and you even up to like 10%, you don't have to modify your car at all. Any car in the country can run on a blend of 10% ethanol, 90% gasoline, and there are many flexible fuel vehicles on the road that can actually run on an 85% ethanol mixture. So my guess is that although what you say is true about methanol, it has proven to be a very hard sell to a lot of companies in the alternative fuel vehicle market.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. We have about 10 minutes left. Let me introduce again our guest, Joseph Rahm. He helped oversee hydrogen and transportation fuel cell research in various positions in the Department of Energy during the Clinton administration. He's the author of a book titled The Hype About Hydrogen, Fact and Fiction in the Race to Save the Climate. It's published by Island Press. He's in bookstores now if you want to look at it. We have some other callers here, and next is someone in Urbana, line number 3. Hello.
Hello?
Mm-hmm.
First, I'd like to say just hooray for the guy who is pushing public transportation. It is just so much better than driving long distances, which is just horrifically boring. But I think people have to drive because they have no other choice. It's not because we want to drive. It's just that we have no choice. I mean, if I want to go to Indianapolis 2 hours away from here and I want to take public transportation, it takes about 10 hours. So because you have to go through Chicago first. And anyway, but my question is... I'm coming from a place of extreme ignorance here, I realize, but hydrogen to me sounds like something extremely explosive. So I don't know if you could get into more specifics about how it is that it works and how it is that your car doesn't burst into flames if you get into a crash.
Sure. No, good question. I talk about the safety issue in the book. All fuels that could run a car are explosive. They burn. Gasoline obviously burns and causes a lot of fires. Hydrogen is an exceedingly flammable gas. It is probably the most flammable of all gases, and it's particularly dangerous because it's invisible and it burns invisibly, so you can have these invisible fires. And that's why when hydrogen is used in industrial settings, there are very strict codes and standards about how you work and operate around hydrogen. In cars, I think the safety issue is quite legitimate. What most people talk about these days is very high-pressure canisters, canisters that are like those big metal tanks that you see in hospitals or universities that carry gases under high pressure. In this case, we're talking about very high pressure, like 5,000 pounds per square inch. Presumably, these canisters would be very, very strong, and they would not break or burst during an accident. Personally, I think that when the more people learn about hydrogen as a fuel, they're probably not going to be that comfortable with, you know, having high-pressure canisters in their cars and at their fueling stations. And most of the automakers have said that they don't think that that way of storing hydrogen is something they want to expose the public to. So most people think we need a major breakthrough in hydrogen storage, that storing hydrogen under high pressure is not practical, and that we're going to need some whole new material that will store hydrogen very safely. But I think you're absolutely correct that there are legitimate safety concerns around hydrogen, just as there is, you know, with natural gas and gasoline. But we've gotten used to gasoline. Mm-hmm. I think hydrogen introduces other problems that may cause some concern.
So no more explosive than gasoline, or?
Well, it's very different than gasoline. Gasoline, you know, one of the biggest problems with gasoline is that in an accident, gasoline can splatter and it can pool.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's a leak, you know, it can pool on the floor and it can catch fire, or it could splatter on you. Hydrogen, of course, being a gas, it would if there were an accident, it would tend to go up and dissipate.
Uh-huh.
So some people consider that to be an advantage.
Uh-huh.
Its disadvantage is that it's very leaky, so that if you had it in a garage, it might leak out and collect in your garage.
Mm.
And then because it could be trapped in your garage and it might get easily ignited. It can be ignited by things like a cell phone. So it's very easy to ignite. That's why in industry, wherever you've got a lot of hydrogen, you have to have massive ventilation so it can't get caught in a bubble. Mm-hmm. My concern is it would be expensive and difficult to enforce those regulations with millions of people and millions of people's garages. You know, how would you guarantee that there's massive ventilation?
Uh-huh.
So I think, you know, there are many practical issues that will complicate any transition to any fuel, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
All right, let's go to Charleston, line four, for someone else here. Hello.
Yes, I too praise the idea of safe, extensive public transport again. We had it once, but it's gone. But in any case, my question is about the emissions, both from the hybrids and from ethanol. I read a piece a little time back about the pollution from the combination of gasoline and ethanol is a new sort of situation, which is more polluting, more poisonous than gasoline. I'll ring off and wait for your answer. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, let me just talk about gasoline and hybrids first. The newest hybrids, like the Toyota Prius and the Ford Escape, are designated partial zero-emission vehicles. And that means if they run on low-sulfur gasoline, which will be mandatory nationwide in 2 years, these are very low-polluting vehicles. They literally have about one-tenth the tailpipe emissions of existing cars, and for instance, the air coming out of those cars is cleaner than Los Angeles air. So that's a very good thing, and I think people who care about the environment should look not only for hybrids but for these partial, they're called PZEVs, partial zero emission vehicles. Ethanol, you know, it is an oxygenate. It's supposed to be designed to reduce carbon monoxide. There are certainly issues about other emissions. I think most people believe that you can design the car so that it has ultra-low emissions with an ethanol blend. But there's no question that, you know, ethanol is not a, you know, pollution-free fuel in the way that electricity could be for an electric car or hydrogen could be in a fuel cell.
We're just about to the point that we have to finish. I do want to ask you quickly, because some people have talked about the potential for the fuel cell for all kinds of applications. Vehicles, yes, but also things like cell phones and laptop computers, and also for residences and for buildings. Where do you think that there is a place for a, particularly for a stationary fuel cell in something like a home or a larger building?
No, I'm glad you asked that. I actually, the book has a couple of chapters on stationary fuel cells. Stationary fuel cells, they would run on natural gas directly converted to hydrogen. They are very efficient, very low polluting. I think they're very promising. I would be surprised. They don't scale down in size very well, so I would be surprised if you saw them in a lot of people's homes. But you might well see them in commercial buildings and industrial facilities and power plants. My guess is that not this decade, but next decade, that may be the decade of the stationary fuel cell, and they might be quite popular. And it is also entirely possible that they become popular for laptops and cell phones, that there are a lot of companies racing to develop these tiny micro fuel cells, and they may well succeed.
Well, there we'll have to leave it with our thanks to our guest, Joseph Rahm. He's the author of the book, The Hype About Hydrogen, Fact and Fiction, and the Race to Save the Climate. He helped oversee hydrogen and transportation fuel cell research in various positions in the Department of Energy during the Clinton administration. Dr. Rahm, thanks very much for talking with us.
You're quite welcome.
Programming here on AM 580 made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. The programming also made possible by a grant from the Living Yoga Center in downtown Champaign, offering a variety of classes designed to help students bring balance into their lives by finding strength and serenity through the practice of yoga. Their summer session begins on Tuesday, June 1st. That's today, with introductory classes and more. For more information, their website is www.livingyogacenter.net, or you may call 384-5829. In the next hour of this show, we'll be looking back to the big blackout of last August, talking about why it happened and what has been done to try to prevent future outages. We'll have two guests with us, George Gross and Peter Sauer. They are both professors of electrical and computer engineering here at University of Illinois. First, though, we're going to take a break for an update on the markets and news. Stay with us.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey looking at the current tick on the market. And boy, are things locked, limit up in the corn and soybean picks. We're going to get to the specifics in just a second. First, a look at the wheat, the July contract at 387.5, up 25.